From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Not for the first time this year, today we are taking note of the increased number of shootings that are plaguing many places around Illinois. In Peoria, for example, the city's homicide rate is at a 30-year record, with many of the victims being young people. We've also had many conversations on mental health and trauma on the program, but today we're going to bring these ideas together to talk about the cycle this can create. People witness violence in their community or their home, and then contribute to the violence in their community or home. And this cycle can be that much harder to interrupt in places where access to trauma-informed care and mental health services are lacking. Our guests today are all working to change this. We're joined now by State Representative Jahan Gordon Booth, a Democrat from Peoria. Back in 2017, she helped secure public funding for trauma recovery centers in the state. Representative Gordon Booth, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by two guests working to break the cycle of trauma and violence in Champaign-Urbana. Karen Crawford Sims is the founding director of the Trauma and Resilience Initiative. We're also joined by Antario Sims. He works with the initiative's violence response team. Karen and Antario, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
Thank you for having me.
And from Rockford, I'd like to welcome Teresa Yaling. She's a licensed clinical social worker and manager of the Strive Trauma Recovery Center, which is part of OSF Healthcare St. Anthony Medical Center. Teresa, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Hello.
Listeners, as ever, we invite you to join the conversation. Have you seen the trauma of violence affecting your community? What do you think should be done to address that? Or just if you have a question or comment for our guests, you can call now. 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. Antario, I want to begin with you. You were born and raised in Champaign-Urbana. When did you first notice an increase in the violence there?
So I noticed the increase in the violence, around when I became a freshman in high school. So that was probably, about 2015. I started to notice an increasing amount of kids that I grew up with, around my neighborhood becoming involved with, having guns and being around older peers who were involved with guns and stuff like that. So, around 2015, I saw an increase in my classmates and my peers, you know, start to veer off and stop coming to school due to this type of violence and, a bunch of stuff like that. And then in my neighborhood, it started to get to where parents would not even let kids come out and play basketball, which was a routine we did every day. That began to slow down due to all the violence in the neighborhood. So yeah, it was about 2015.
And so just to be clear about that, it sounds like this is not something that just happened because, you know, people get older, they start doing different things in life. This is something that was different from when you were a kid. People used to go out, play ball, whatever they're doing.
Exactly.
And that changed. Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely changed, you know, and, people started to get, you know, real scared and, it was just something that now, you know, you ride through the neighborhoods and you hardly see kids out playing anymore just due to the violence.
Karen, have you noticed that increase either in work or just in life?
So, yes, and, issues of trauma and violence tend to wax and wane with a variety of different social and cultural factors. So Ontario and I have a little bit of an age difference. So I've seen something similar in the middle of the crack epidemic, right, where there was escalating violence and lots of tension, and things sort of settled down for a while. We put some programs, services, and supports. There were some infrastructure things. And as those sort of supports eased and access to guns increased, we're back into the swing. So I've seen, you know, these blips on more than one occasion in my lifetime.
Representative Gordon Booth, I want to ask you, your district is in Peoria, which has set already a tragic record in 2021, 26 homicides. That's the most in three decades. Can you talk about the violence in Peoria this year and whether you see a greater need to address the trauma that's there?
Quite frankly, I would say that we are really at a critical place. I would say that when you go back and you look at the history and similar to what Karen spoke about as it relates to the crime that, you know, those of us that were around, I was a child, but during the 90s, during the crack epidemic, we saw, you know, really challenging rates of crime. I would also add that, you know, that it wasn't just Peoria, like now we're seeing this around the country. And I think that one of the things that we have to be really mindful about is that environment in the 90s is what created an environment where the 94 crime bill was passed. And, you know, when we look back over the decades, we see that that was not the answer, right? The true answer is the work that we're all doing, right? It's the work of, you know, identifying victims before they become perpetrators. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of children who are living in families that have been destabilized by mass incarceration. They've been destabilized by substance abuse and the parents not being able to get the adequate supports for the issues that they have. And then that their parents' trauma is then passed down to them. And what we're seeing in Peoria is what you're seeing happening really across the country. You're seeing, you know, perpetrators who are incredibly young. We are seeing children, and I call them children because they're literally 11, 12, and 13 years old. The latest victim of crime, of homicide victim in Peoria was a 15-year-old kid at Manual High School. And so we, all of us that are in these spaces, we all have a role to play in ensuring that our communities are getting the requisite trauma supports before a life and death situation happens with them or to someone that they love.
Okay, you mentioned requisite trauma supports. I want to put a pin in that for a minute. And Teresa, let's just talk about this word trauma. I think maybe to some people that can feel a little clinical, a little removed. Can you talk about the ways people, you know, what does this viscerally mean to people in communities that are experiencing trauma?
Sure. I think when people think of trauma in general, they may even think of like someone who possibly had been like a war veteran or an adult trauma. They're not understanding that children are experiencing trauma. It is, I suppose, now I think being used a lot more, and it is more clinical. But I mean, when something like this happens as a child is growing up, I mean, you're interfering with their brain development, and it's causing a lot of the symptoms that we think of when we do think of war veterans, which is, you know, the intrusive memories, the nightmares and flashbacks, startle responses, very hypervigilant, depressed, irritable, you know, numb. You see a lot of kids being very numb. Eating disorders, chronic pain. We have a lot more issues with, you know, chronic pain and autoimmune issues, you know, that people just, they don't understand where it's coming from, kinds of things. So, I mean, yeah, when you think of trauma, it's actually not just adults, and it's happening from the time before they're even born. These things can interrupt the child development. And therefore, when these kids are growing up, they're making decisions based off of what I say, sort of like a film of trauma. They're, you know, so their brain isn't fully developed. It's not developing correctly. Things like that.
A film. So like a film over their eyes, or, you know, we have that mm-hmm. phrase rose colored glasses. This would be
right.
something else.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Have you noticed I guess this is almost answers itself, but what an increased need for this, you know, the sort of services to deal with this in the Rockford area where you are?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, the reason for Rockford having a trauma recovery center is tied to our sister hospital in Peoria, St. Francis. And they have a trauma recovery center there. And really, they thought, why not Rockford? I mean, we are about the same as far as crime is concerned. And, you know, I mean, literally, like, we are about tied with murders and whatnot. And in Rockford, we have, for the longest time, have been on the top 10 list for one of the worst places to live in the country because of our crime rate. We have superseded Chicago's crime rate for years, if you look at per capita, of course. But the crime is just unreal, and gun violence is huge. And actually right now, too, I mean, we've been trying to address domestic violence because almost 40% of our crime is due to just domestic violence issues. So gun violence with that and general gang and other just gun violence.
Yeah, and we've talked about Rockford's special approach there. Let me, Karen, come back to you. We heard Teresa there describing the sort of individual effects, be it from, you know, mood changes to actual immune physical, you know, body experiences of trauma. I want to ask you, though, what effect does that individual trauma have on the community, Karen?
So that's a great question, because I love using SAMHSA's definition of trauma, which are events, experiences, and the effects there are. So traumas in general are things that are painful, that are shaping and defining, that alter our sense of our worldview. So and depending on the kind of trauma and when it happens, has those neurobiological right changes. So poverty, sort of being environments where you are oppression, experiencing structural inequalities, all of those things are variables that for some people are traumatic. So if you think about, everybody has their own individual risk and protective factors, and we're always sort of balancing the scale. So that's the commercial about trauma. So if you think about that in the aggregate, so a neighborhood that is experiencing or has been impacted by structural violence, right? Like under-resourced, lack of good education, fewer economic opportunities. We now can measure, we've seen that kind of chronic stress shortens the telomeres, increases people's level of cortisol, increases people's fight, flight, freeze response. So we know people present, like in some communities, up to 1 in 6 boys of color might present with the signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. So people are hypervigilant, on guard, defended. Sometimes when it exists over time and across generations, people experience more hopelessness and helplessness. There are more substance use and addictions. And so in short, I would like to say a number of things that people sort of associate with low wealth, marginalized urban communities. If you could see those as the symptoms of trauma, not as the sort of thing that exists in isolation, it is what you get. So the built environment is stressful. People, right? All of those sort of maladaptive behaviors that people, again, associate with urban living are all a reflection of what happens to the brain and body when you're stressed over time.
Okay, we need to take a break here coming up. So I'm going to just take a moment to reintroduce my guests. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking about trauma and violence and the cycle that that can create in communities across Illinois and what some people are doing to try and interrupt that cycle. And we're going to get more to that, to what when we continue our conversation about what is actually being done to try and break this cycle. We're speaking with Karen Sims, who's the founding director of the Trauma and Resilience Initiative in the Champaign-Urbana area. Also, Antonio Sims, who works as part of that initiative, healing communities and responds to community violence. We're also speaking with State Representative Jahan Gordon Booth of Peoria, who has worked to have state funding of trauma response centers, and Teresa Yaling, manager at the Strive Trauma Recovery Center, which is part of OSF St. Anthony Medical Center in Rockford. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. We have a text message from a teacher that we're going to share after the break. But if you want to call in, 800-222-9455. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're speaking about how communities in Illinois are addressing trauma from violence. We're speaking with Antonio Sims, who works with healing communities and community violence response as part of Trauma and Resilience Initiative Incorporated in the Champaign-Urbana area. Also, Karen C. Sims, who's founding director of the initiative. Also, Illinois State Representative Jahan Gordon Booth from Peoria. And Teresa Yaling, who's an LCSW and a manager for the OSF Strive Trauma Recovery Center in Rockford. Our lines are open at 800-222-9455. How has violence affected your community? Has trauma from violence affected your community? 800-222-9455 is the number. We got a text message from a listener who says, I'm a teacher at a local high school and one that has seen a major uptick in violence, both guns and fighting. I often wonder if enough people seek out trauma counseling. We wave it around as if this is the answer. I personally feel it has to be a multi-prong approach where policing, counseling, and work programs work together to address all of these problems together. And then she asks, would you say that kids are becoming desensitized to violence and therefore more likely to perpetrate it? Antonio, let me ask you, you're a community responder. What sort of conversations are you having with people in the community about this?
I must first say my personal opinion, because I believe that kids are starting to become decentralized to this, because me personally, I work through a program called Go Getters. I work directly with high school students. And nowadays it seems as though violence is just, you know, something normal. You know what I mean? You got people listening to music that's strictly violence. You got kids playing video games that are violent. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on. And when I talk to the kids personally, they speak on violence. It's not super, I don't know how to say it. It's not something that they speak on it lightly. Let me say that, you know, it's not something that's super, you know, crazy nowadays, you know. So with all this stuff going on, it's almost like every day there's something going on. So people just kind of look at it and they're like, man, just another incident. You know what I mean? So it's not really, you know, like it's just taken too lightly.
It's like just a part of life now is what it sounds like you're saying.
Basically.
Yeah. What do you think is contributing to this violence? If you had to, you know, list out some things. Other than what you've been talking about, I mean, you sort of describe the effects maybe of people being desensitized, but Do you have an idea of what might be contributing to it?
Main thing contributing to it is these big mainstream, media people and artists, you know what I mean? And you got companies nowadays that strictly promote violence before they promote positivity. So, you know, when they put negative stuff out with ease, but it's a big push to put out something positive, you know what I mean? That's a big contributor to it, you know. We're quick to always, as soon as something happens, we post the negative, but we kind of fall short to post the positive stuff. So we got to get better with that. And another big contributor, you know what I mean, is kids nowadays, they're sitting in classrooms with teachers that are completely overwhelmed, you know what I mean? So nowadays the teachers are so overwhelmed, they don't have the time to, work with someone specifically and address the problems that they may be facing because they got so much stuff going on. So, you know, a big stress on teachers plays a role in, the violence, I feel like.
Representative Gordon Booth, I want to ask you, you've obviously seen the effects of trauma firsthand in your community, but you have a personal experience. We've talked about this. To the extent you're comfortable, can you talk about your son, DJ?
certainly. DJ is my son. My husband, Derek, and I have three children. DJ, who will forever be 22, Chancellor, who is now 19 and headed to the Air Force, and a 7-year-old daughter who was in second grade. I say that DJ will be forever 22 because DJ was shot and killed at a birthday party when I was actually 9 months pregnant with our daughter. The work that I do around the trauma space, so the work that was born out of the pain of losing our son DJ is what created Trauma Recovery Centers, because it was very clear to me that the person that killed our son was someone that both my husband and I knew. My husband used to do prison ministry with the gentleman who took our son's life. Like, he would go into, Department of Corrections and minister to men who were incarcerated. And for that same person to then take the life of our son was obviously as shattering as you would probably imagine, and probably a little bit worse. But when you begin to peel back the layers of how something like that could have happened at a birthday party of his friends, and why many of his friends who were with him did not come forward, but why it actually took women that were mothers that also shared a trauma bond of having lost brothers, fathers, nephews to gun violence, why it took for those women to step forward to provide justice to DJ's life. You know, it really did something to me, and it did something to our family. The space of trauma, and how it continues to impact people over the years, rather, as was stated earlier, rather it's domestic violence, rather it's, community or family trauma. One of the questions that was asked earlier was about the do we think that children or young people are being desensitized? That's without question. And the other thing that was stated was, by the listener who called in with the question, I think she was a high school teacher, and she asked the question of, are there enough people who are getting trauma supports? Well, if we're gonna be specific, which I think we should be, the majority of the crime as it relates to community violence and homicide, it's happening within the Black community, Black and brown communities, but primarily the Black community. One of the things that I think that we have to do is we have to encourage more people within the community to go into counseling for behavioral health as an occupation, because oftentimes people who are from a community have a much better ability to connect with people who are in the community because there's a familiarity there. So I think that one of our roles as leaders is encouraging other young Black men and women to go into the space of behavioral health so that they can then work in these spaces in a professional certified capacity. One of the other issues that I think that we have to really begin to hone in on, and it's one of the things that I really focus on around trauma recovery centers. We started this work, the trauma recovery center work was born out of the Neighborhood Safety Act, which I passed in, which was signed into law in March 2017. We started with one trauma recovery center. We've now been able to grow that footprint to over 10 communities across the state. And one of the things that I try to do is I try to provide as much of a hands-on approach as I can to show communities how they have the ability to build these trauma recovery centers out using a underutilized school building, because one of the entities in our communities that is considered neutral oftentimes are our school buildings. And many of our, because of geography and people moving out in the more suburban, smaller community areas, many of our urban school districts are underutilized. So one of the things that we are encouraging individuals that, you know, enter into this trauma recovery space is to actually put those trauma recovery services inside of an underutilized school building in those zip codes that are the most impacted by crime, violence, and by trauma. And then not just having the trauma recovery services, but building out wraparound services that are very specific to that community, whether it be a food pantry, one of the number one reasons why young people violate juvenile probation is because they miss their probation appointments. That is a direct reflection of the parent not getting that child to that appointment because they're not an adult. By putting juvenile probation inside of what we call the wraparound center, which is also where the trauma recovery center is, we have been able to decrease the amount of young people who have been recidivating and going back to JDC. Having services from a federally qualified healthcare center, having housing services all housed within one place, what it does is it begins to lift the stigma. Because most people that are experiencing trauma, whether it be trauma from violence or crime, chances are they are also dealing with things like food insecurity. Chances mm-hmm. are they are dealing with some form of housing insecurity. And even if they haven't, they will in the future. So by creating these one-stop shop wraparound center concepts, what we have the ability to do is destigmatize what it means to actually get the support that one may have, that one may need when they are experiencing PTSD, because they may be coming in for one thing, but end up getting support from some other spaces. Also, and I would like to end on this.
Sure.
Is that oftentimes when people are experiencing trauma, they don't even know what it is because it's been normalized by their parents, by their grandparents, and the other people in their lives and in their neighborhood. But once the layers of trauma begin to get unpacked, one of the things that we have to be mindful of is because I experience a traumatic experience today, doesn't mean that I am prepared for trauma supports tomorrow. We have to know that we have to keep our hands on people. And we have the ability to do that through data, to keep our hands on people who we know are experiencing crime and violence, because we can pull that from all of our local police data. And then when it is necessary, instead of always necessarily suspending people, expelling people, because we know what trauma and violence does to the DNA, particularly of young people, we should then be going in with proper trauma supports in hopes that in that moment of, you know, potentially suspension or expulsion, you know, we should be doing some mandated supports for those young people so that we can hold on to this generation that we so desperately need to be leaning into in a way that is from the way in which we have operated up until this point in a very non-traditional way. Our young people are our assets for the future. And I don't think we're doing enough to capture and meeting them where they are at.
Well, Karen, let me ask you about that then. Are you counting on people to come in? Are you going out to bring people in? You know, and what about what the representative said there? Sometimes people aren't ready the next morning to have that conversation? You have to stay on them. How does that work in your area?
So a couple different things. One is, right, the research around what trauma recovery looks like is sometimes a little bit different than what people will, how people conceptualize it. So the caller asked, are trauma recovery centers the answer? And they're never, so no evidence-based practice will say there's one solution. There are a bunch of different strategies that need to be in place. So I encourage the caller to always think that this is one piece of a larger pie. And we, for example, prioritize trying to make sure that there is access to mental health supports that look in lots of different creative ways, because actually traditional talk therapy for many survivors isn't the best practice. So we use something called psychological first aid and skills for psychological recovery, two evidence-based practices that we train lay people to do so that they can be available at the place of an immediate crisis to provide those comfort and care, basic needs, also some real concrete skills that, again, a mama, a grandmama, a church member, a neighbor can do that statistically, that's been well researched, that actually actually prevents the need for more intensive therapeutic support. So we believe neighbor by neighbor, block by block, if we can build the capacity so that more and more people have trusted adults, people who can teach them the coping and resiliency skills that don't have to be professionalized, the more healthy a community can be. That way, the trauma-specific treatments that we don't have enough of, like in Champaign, we have probably only two therapists who are African-American, who are trained in evidence-based practices. And even at the places that most people go for therapy, there are very few people trained in the evidence-based practices that would help with recovery. And so imagine if you keep going to a doctor or a therapist and they treat you generically for a disease, but not specifically for your illness, it is very hard. Like, you're not going to get better. And actually, it actually creates this really, it reinforces that feeling of distrust that many people have from this, from with systems. So we do a lot of stigma busting, a lot of media marketing, a lot of normalization. And we haven't talked about resiliency enough on this call, but what we also know is that the more people can be engaged in activities, sure, recreation, play, joy, gardening, nature, the more they have those protective factors, trusted adults, the better they're able to weather storms. So when bad things happen, they don't fall apart. But as we dismantle neighborhoods and structures, right, people are so vulnerable because they don't have the care that they need to stay well.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Karen Sims, Representative Jahan Gordon Booth, Antario Sims, and Teresa Yaling, thank you so much for being with us today on The 21st. More to come in just a moment.
Support for The 21st comes from Christie Clinic. Christie Clinic, providing health care to the community for more than 90 years. Local procedures, providers, specialties, and choice. Christie Clinic is focused on caring for the community. Support comes from the Champaign Park District, presenting Renee Elise Goldsberry, original Broadway cast member from Hamilton, live in concert at the Virginia Theater on Saturday, November 6th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information are available online at thevirginia.org.